If you didn't get a chance to grab an outline, there are, I assume, there are some still out on the table in the foyer. There actually are not any, so. Okay. Well, that means several are dispersed throughout the audience, so you know what I'm talking about tonight. There was a little bit of a snafu on my part, a little copy and paste error in the bulletin announcing the sermon. So I repeated, the morning sermon for this evening and then from last morning, if I remember. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Had the wrong one down for tonight. And then, of course, Edward, we asked him to do a special lesson this morning and appreciate him doing that. Did a good job. And so anyway, got off track a little bit. Tonight, if you're looking at your outline, you'll notice that the title of the lesson is maybe a strange one, but the social drinking lifestyle. This is going to be a lesson in which I'm going to talk about alcohol a little bit, not a lot, but a little bit at least. I'm going to talk about the sin of drunkenness, but more than that, I'm going to take a look at three passages in particular. Those of you that are looking at your outline, you can see those listed under the second point and the very first letter A. But we'll get to them, and we're going to take them one by one and look at some of the things that are said, not everything, but some of the things that are said within each one. I want to talk a little bit about a lifestyle that exists out in the world that I think, my opinion, so take this with a grain of salt, but I think this lifestyle is growing. And as Edward was talking a little bit this morning about humanism being pervasive in our society, I think what we're seeing more and more is that this lifestyle that was all but ubiquitous in the Roman world, I mean, almost everyone practiced it, and Christians had to deal with it, is fast becoming that way in our society. And hopefully, we'll at least get to thinking about some of that in just a moment. I want to start off, however, with an illustration. I was talking with a local member of the church, not from here, but she is local, and I was talking to her about her conversion. Oftentimes, we go to meetings or whatever, and this occurred at such an occasion, and we get to talking with people, and, you know, people will ask you how you came to be a member of the church, especially in this area. Most people, some did, but most people did not grow up as I didn't, and as many of you didn't, as children of members of the church, but rather you were converted. That was the case with her, and she talked a little bit about her conversion. She had been a member of a major denomination locally, and she said she was motivated to begin investigating, or as she put it, seriously investigating the scriptures to, you know, check out the denomination she was part of and so forth. But she said it came, she had questions already, to be sure, but it came really after an incident with her clergy, as she put it. And the clergy of the church was demanding that she keep some particular, and it really was, a small point. Sometimes small points are very much major points in certain denominations. We'll get off on that tangent. But they were demanding that she keep this particular small point, and the clergyman was rebuking her for not keeping it. And as he was kind of up in her face rebuking her, she said, he reeked of alcohol on his breath. So she got to thinking about that and the inconsistencies of that. And she's thinking, you're demanding I keep this small point, and you're a hypocrite standing there with alcohol on your breath. You've obviously been drinking, and maybe that's why you're a little agitated at me over this rather insignificant point. It moved her to really look into scriptures, and eventually she changed and became a member of the church. I thought that was a very interesting point, and I thought it illustrated how people that we would consider in the world, even, how people view, still view, alcohol. I'll come back to that point at the end of the lesson, but I want to go beyond that a little bit. I'm going to make a couple of observations. Again, these are my opinion. You don't have to agree with these. But I believe that drinking or alcohol or whatever has become a major social practice or habit of our day. I watched part of, I didn't really have time the other night, and it came on successive nights, and I was in and out with various things. But I watched pieces of a three-part documentary, if you want to call it whatever, on television that had to do with the history of alcohol in America. Some of you may have caught that. I think it was a repeat, so it probably was on earlier. Long story short, they went back and showed how things have changed. The societal mores about alcohol changed, the European influence that it had, what it took to lead up to the amendment to the Constitution, bringing in prohibition, and what it took to get rid of that. And it talked about society and the different feelings, just in general, and that was the part I was more concerned with of all of it, but the feelings in general society had about drinking, about alcohol, and how that now we have moved to a different position. We're not anywhere like we once were in the Puritan age. We're certainly not like we were in the 1800s. We're not like the Prohibition days and all of that. We've moved into something totally different. And they gave illustrations. I wish I could have seen more of it because that was the part I was particularly interested in. I missed most of it. But they were giving illustrations of just the advertising campaigns, the commercials that you see on television, the conversations with people, the interviews, the jokes that people tell, the comments that are made. And this is really the part that I focus on. The comments people make in passing. Like, for example, if someone happens to be on a game show or being interviewed out on the street for something totally unrelated and how a joke might slip in or a snide remark or a side comment, a sidebar, or whatever you want to call it, and how it conveys the preeminence, almost, of alcohol in our society. And I thought all of that was interesting, and again, I'd like to see more of that. But because of all of that, and you'll see that I put on the outline, there's a heightened sense of pressure on the Christian. If you abstain, where once a lot of people abstained, not as many do anymore. And if you abstain, then you really are an exception. People are surprised by that. Some people are annoyed at it. If you are someone who goes even further than just abstinence, and you would actually say, I don't believe in drinking, or I don't believe in the use of alcohol, people will take great exception to it. It becomes almost a religious fervor about the alcohol. I think you can see in our society that drinking has become, as I said, a major social practice. It's a habit. It is something that is habitually practiced. You will see people saying, and I heard a comment recently and jotted it down. Someone was talking about fishing. I think this happened to be, if I'm thinking right, this was on a biography about Leonard Skinner, but don't take that with me. I'm not sure about that. But the comment caught my eye or my ear. And the comment was made, you can't go fishing without beer. Now, I thought back to the days that I went fishing, loved to fish, and I love fishing. And yeah, I remember that a lot of people drank beer going fishing. But, you know, to me, the fishing, I could go fishing without beer. I did a lot of drinking of beer, and I did a lot of fishing, but I could go fishing without beer. But this comment, you can't go fishing without beer. I've noticed that the holidays, and when people talk about holidays, and if you watch this, listen to the newscasters, etc. on television, holidays have become centered around festivities that have to do with alcohol. If we're going to celebrate 4th of July, many people are going to celebrate 4th of July by drinking. If you're going to celebrate New Year's, you're going to celebrate New Year's by drinking. If you're going to have a Christmas celebration, the Christmas celebration is going to have drinking. Your birthday is going to be about drinking. All kinds, every kind of social function has got to have alcohol, if not at the very basis or root or foundation of it, certainly involved in it. It says something about our society. It says something about where we as a people are. And when there's more and more pressure upon a Christian to at least condone it or accept it, we've got to be asking ourselves as Christians, should we? Should I engage in it? Should I accept it? Should I condone it? What should my stance be? So I want to talk a little bit about that tonight. I think there are things we should consider as Christians, and I believe the Bible makes it clear the picture, at least, of alcohol and its place in, let's say, Paul's world or Peter's world. I'm going to look at three passages. I'd like for you to start with me at Galatians chapter 5. Now, I'm going to go outside these, but only during the last 10 minutes or so of the lesson. For about 20 minutes or so, we're going to stay focused on just three passages. So if you'll look with me at Galatians 5, if I can remember where Galatians is, but if you look with me at Galatians chapter 5, this is where Paul talks about the fruit of the Spirit as opposed to the works of the flesh. Now, I'm looking at, and for this lesson I considered in particular, never have done this before, not like this. I've certainly preached on drinking, and I've preached on social drinking, and so forth and so on. But I've never looked at these three passages. It started with my noticing a particular word. I'm going to mention it in just a little bit. But a particular word that's used only three times in the New Testament, and it happens to be used in all three of these passages only. And it got me to thinking. And I got to thinking about the groupings. In each one of them, there is a grouping of sins or a grouping of things that are wrong. And to notice how with each one of them, that what is in common between the three passages, and I'll say it like this, the thing that's common in all three is the drunkenness and this term and one or two others, and we're going to look at those. So if you look at Galatians 5, you'll notice Paul says, the works of the flesh are manifest, which are these. He says adultery, fornication. Some of your versions only use one of those terms. But fornication, uncleanness, lasciviousness. Idolatry, witchcraft, the King James says. Hatred, variance, emulations, words that have to do with violence. Wrath, strife, seditions, heresies, the idea of, you know, people opposing each other, being against one another. Envying certainly factoring into that. Murders. Then he uses the term drunkenness. I think we all understand what it means to get drunk, at least those of us that are older. But drunkenness, he says, revelings, the King James uses the term, and such like. And when you realize when he says, and such like, that Paul is saying this is not an exhaustive list, but these are all the kinds of things, and if you'll hear me carefully, these are all the kinds of things that go together, and they're all, what is common about all of them is that they are all works of the flesh. And you'll notice what he goes on to say, of the which, that is these kinds of things, whether they're listed here or not. You know, pornography is not listed here, but I think we'd all say it's a work of the flesh. He says, of the which I told you before, and as I've also told you in time past, that they which do such things shall not inherit the kingdom of God. Now, he's explicit about the detrimental effect of engaging in these kinds of things. And that's why we should think about them. There are other passages, and I'd like for you to go with me now to Romans 13, and I'm going to stay in Romans 13. I'll refer back to Galatians 5, but I'm going to stay in Romans 13 for a moment. You notice in Romans 13, Paul says something similar, not exactly the same. It's not portrayed in exactly the same way. But if you look at the end of Romans 13, Paul says it like this. He's warning us that the time is far spent, the night is far spent. And it's really time that we should be considering things seriously, is the idea. You'll see that in verse 12. The day is at hand. Let us therefore cast off the works of darkness in this passage, works of flesh in Galatians 5. And let us put on the armor of light. Now, let me slow down a little bit at verse 12, and let me make a brief comment about it. I think any time you're talking, that sounded weird. Almost sounded like my voice cracked like I was a teenager again. If only. But nonetheless. Anyway, let me get back to where I was. I think anytime you're talking about alcohol, you're talking about all of this kind of thing, that a lot of what you believe and how you feel about it, what you think, has to do with where you are in life. I've lived long enough, I believe, that now I can look back and I can see a time when I was a teenager. I was young. The feelings I had then. Now I'm middle-aged and moving toward being a senior citizen. Still got a ways to go yet before I hit what would be considered old age, but I'm getting there. And I believe that your feelings change about it all. I think that what happens when you're very young, I think Scripture would even bear this out, that when you're very young, you're very confident, things are black and white, you're sure about things. You believe you know yourself and you know others. You feel, to a degree, invincible. sure, you know that, you know, somebody might tell you you can die at any time, and you, yeah, no, I can't, but you don't really believe it. I mean, you just haven't had close brushes with death before, and you don't really think of yourself. You know if you get in your car and go 100 miles an hour, you can die. You just don't believe you will. So when warnings are given, whether they're from the pulpit like tonight, or some, you know, parent or older person, you know, putting their arm around you and telling you something, or you read it in a book, or you see it on television, you know, it really, you hear it, but you don't hear it. Because you are confident of you. You know what you think. You know what you believe. And even if you struggle with it, even if there's a part of you, at least this was the case with me, if there's a part of me that questions and wonders and doubts even, you know, what I'm doing, at the same time, I sort of feel invincible. I'm strong. I'm at the peak of my life. I think back to when I was 25 years old, and I look at the strength I had, and, you know, at that time, you're grown up a little bit, so you've got some knowledge. I mean, you just feel like you're on top of everything. Then you get older. And when you hit old age, what you see in a lot of older people is that they're a lot weaker about things. Now, don't misunderstand. I'm talking about things where they were so sure of everything in life. They're not sure of things in life. They've lived long enough to see people fail them. They've seen things that shouldn't happen, happen too many times. They've seen things they never dreamed of or suspected come to pass. And so they're not like they were at 25. At 75, you just ain't 25 anymore. And there are people like me. And they're sort of in between. And they're close enough to being 25. They remember what that feels like. But now enough has happened where they're getting to that 75. It depends on where you are. So when you read a passage like Romans 13, you're going to think three different ways about it. And chances are great if you're in this audience and you're closer to 25, you're going to think one way. And if you're closer to 50, like I am, you're going to think another. And if you're closer to 75, you're going to think still another way about it. But listen again to what Paul says. The night is far spent. The day is at hand. Let us. And that means a Christian of any age, 25, 50, or 75. Let us, therefore, cast off the works of darkness. And let us put on the armor of light. Now he says this. Let us walk honestly. You have another translation, like as not, it says, either decently, many translations say, or honorably. But those are the ideas. Not honest in the sense of telling the truth necessarily, though there's a sense of that. But more the idea of honorable or decent living. So let us walk honorably or decently, as in the day. Things you could do right out in the open for everybody to see is the point. And then he explains what he means. Not in. And he uses a number of terms. Now, I said I would come to a term that's common in all three. And the very first word Paul uses is that word. If you go back to Galatians 5, you see it. You see where Paul uses the term, and depending on your translation, revelings, or rioting, or carousings, a number of translations say. And you may have the same translation in verse 13. Rioting, or reveling, or revelry, or carousing. King James says rioting. It's an interesting term. And again, it occurs in all three of these passages, Galatians 5, Romans 13, and the passage Philip read in 1 Peter 4. What does it mean? What's the idea here? It's a term, an obscure term. In fact, I was looking at different ways it's translated and different ideas about it. And one of the most interesting things I found about it was in a 5th century lexicon by Hesychius. You don't need to know all that, but the point is, this was an ancient lexicon of a guy who was like writing a dictionary in the 5th century when the term was still being used out in society. And that's very interesting to me because how was the word used in that day? And I'm going to read you a quote from Hesychius here. Hesychius said this word that's used three times in the New Testament, this word signifies unclean and dissolute, that is like self-indulgent type things. It can be songs or banquets, feastings, anything like that. But it's overindulgent or self-indulgence that involves all of these things. He said it's associated closely with drunkenness. I don't think that's surprising, because if you'll notice, Galatians 5, drunkenness, revelry. Romans 13, verse 13, rioting, drunkenness. Again, in 1 Peter 4, and we will get there, excess of wine and revelry, rioting, or whatever. They're terms that are right beside each other, closely connected, and occur only in these three passages. And so Hesekiah said it's associated closely with drunkenness itself, that is, this word, rioting or whatever, itself signifies drunken festivals. And he says, really, it's a term that is used to describe what happens or what people do when they gather together in these days, when they would gather together, and they would worship some idol, and then they would party. In other words, if you go back and you read descriptions of, you know, things that happen in that day and time, idolatry that was widespread throughout the Roman world, throughout the Israelite world, you know, the Canaanites, etc. You see people engaging in idolatry, and basically they sacrifice to their idol, whatever that idol is. They sacrifice to the idol, and then they party. And the partying had all kinds of things involved in it. It had people, you know, it had music, usually loud music and so forth. The descriptions that you read in history are the pounding of the drum. Not the playing of the drums, mind you, but the pounding of the drums, which beat, got inside people and drove people to move themselves. The wild dancing that went on at these festivals. So you had the music and you had the dancing. And then, generally what happened was that there was illicit, and I mean wildly illicit, sexual behavior. If you're into this kind of thing of going back and reading from history, go back and research the history behind Valentine's Day. It's an incredible thing. It was not the, you know, send a Valentine and would you be my Valentine and a box of candy. When you hear all of that and you read all of that and you listen to this lexicographer who is telling you the word that sums up all of that activity is Paul's word here, rioting. A particular Greek word, but you know, no point in saying that. But this word that is translated rioting or revelry or carousing. Now when you see that and you begin to think about it and you start thinking about our day and you think about the activities in our day, the partying, the clubbing, the wild gatherings of people that has the music, that has the loudness, it has the sexual, promiscuous sexual activity, etc., etc. And where everything seems to be all connected and interconnected, then one begins to see a lifestyle. And the lifestyle that's emerging is not simply a drink. Alcohol is not simply this harmless substance where two people take a drink. And, you know, and you hear all of this, you know, my doctor said take one for my health. Okay, whoopee. We're not talking about that. You know, and we're not talking about a harmless, you know, business gathering where people sit down and, you know, you see the very sophisticated side of it and they have a martini before lunch. Now, I'm not condoning any of that. Don't misunderstand. But we just are not talking about that. We're talking about rather a lifestyle that permeates our society, where society, our society, interconnects all these things the same way Paul's ancient society did. This is nothing new to America in 2011. This is something that man has been engaging in for thousands of years. We may not have, you know, you might not find the Canaanites 4,000 years ago having a techno DJ, you know, and a bottle of Jim Beam. But they had alcohol, and they had the music, and they certainly had the sexual promiscuity. And the dancing certainly was just like the dancing of our day, that is simulated sexual movements that anybody in their right mind can see. And that's exactly what this lexicographer was saying. And one looks at Romans 13 and reads it again. Put off the works of darkness. Walk decently. Live decently. Live honorably. as in the day. Not as something that would have to be done under cover of darkness, as the phrase goes, or in a closed-off room, or whatever it might be, because if certain people saw it, you would be ashamed. If you had to carry Jesus to the activity, you'd be ashamed. But rather something you could do out in the open, not in rioting, all of this revelry, not in drunkenness, not in the chambering that tends to go with it. The chambering here is a word that, and it's translated cohabitation or debauchery or sexual promiscuity in various translations. It all has to do with the sexual bed. Incidentally, in a different context, the word translated chambering here that obviously has to do with fornication is the same word you'll find over in Hebrews 13 that says the marriage bed is undefiled. Nothing wrong with the act. God instituted the act in the Garden of Eden. But the act outside of marriage, in every case, 100% of the time, is wrong. And that's the difference. You continue to look at these various passages. Go over with me. Well, why don't we just stay here, Romans 13, and finish it. Noticing, as he also says here in this passage, and I'll drop down a point or two. You can see it on your lesson. I added something here from 1 Peter 4, but I'll go to it in just a second. But notice in verse 13 as he continues, the chambering, the wantonness. Now, it is a word that occurs in 1 Peter 4, but let's just use it from Romans 13. Wantonness means filthy behavior. You don't have to, and I want you to hear this. Someone asked me this. Can you show me the verses in the Bible that condemn not fornication, but other things like that? And they said, and I think you know what I mean. I said, sure, I'd be glad to. One of those terms is wanton. There are several terms. But one of them is wantonness. And the word for wantonness is translated in different ways. You may have a translation. You may be looking at it right now. It's translated sometimes unclean behavior or filthy acts or things like that. It's the kind of thing that's not clean. It's the kind of thing that is not acceptable. It's the kind of activity that's not wholesome. It's the kind of activity that is not chaste. If we began to use terms like that, it's the kind of activity that's not sober. It's not wise. I'm not so old that I don't understand that if I were with someone other than my wife and I started engaging in activity, and you know exactly what I mean, not fornication, not the act, but other things, that it would be unwise and it would not be wholesome. And it would not be chaste. And it would not be right. Now, I don't think anyone would deny that. And I think if anyone looks at me and says, you're married, you don't have a right to do so and so, that's only one step away from you saying to yourself, neither do I. If I'm not married and I'm doing something with a member of the opposite sex that I should not be doing. That's exactly what Paul is talking about here. You don't have to be chambering in the bed. You can be doing other things that are short of the act. That's exactly what he's saying. Notice as he goes on to say, drop down to verse 14. I'm not going to look at every term here, but look in verse 14 when he says this, put you on the Lord Jesus Christ. And then notice this phrase, make not provision for the flesh. The idea here is premeditating, giving forethought. In other words, this is not getting caught up in a moment. Understand the difference. You can get caught up in a moment, and I understand that. But you can also premeditate it. You can plan for it. You can be, and I'll be blunt about it, because someone asked me to be. You can be planning to go on a date tonight. And you can be thinking in your mind of dressing a certain way in case, and I want you to hear this, in case it gets to that point. I'm talking about, for example, the selection of undergarments or whatever that you choose. If that's not premeditating and that's not making provision for the flesh, then you tell me what it is. I mean, Paul is talking about the idea of planning, of forethought that goes into the sin. Not just getting caught up in the moment is wrong. But there are times when you're not caught up in the moment. You plan for it. Look over at 1 Peter chapter 4 and listen to a couple of other things that Peter adds. Now, Peter adds a number of these same terms. No need to repeat them. But look at a couple of other things that Peter says. And again, you might say, okay, seem like we changed gears here. We're not talking about alcohol. About to tie the two together. Because Peter uses a term that does that. Look at 1 Peter chapter 4 and drop down with me where Philip was reading to verse 3. For the time past of our life may have sufficed or satisfied us to have wrought or worked the will of the Gentiles, the will of the world. In other words, what Peter is saying is there might have been a time in your life when it was satisfactory to you and the lifestyle you lived to just do what the rest of the world does. But not now. Not as a Christian. He says, when we walked in, notice past tense, we walked in lasciviousness, lust, excess of wine. Now, I want to focus on that term. If you're looking at your outline, it's right at the bottom of the page, excess of wine. It's a compound word. You don't normally find the two parts of the word you see throughout the New Testament. But you don't normally see a compound word. And that's why it's translated like this, excess of wine. Well, it doesn't just mean drunkenness. Sometimes it's translated that way, but most major translations will do something else with it. And here's why. Because it means, literally, to be hot with wine. It's a term that means to boil with wine. Or to be heated up or inflamed with wine. Now, what does that mean? Well, it means alcohol has an effect on you. If you get to thinking about some of the things that people say of alcohol and the way it's used, why do we drink? I mean, really. I don't know. I'm sure most people in this room, adults, have tasted alcohol. If not, then somebody's told you about it. If you drink alcohol, the first time you ever drink it, I will assure you, even wine, but especially just straight alcohol, burns like mad. You have to get used to it. Just like beer, you have to develop a taste for it. Most people don't like beer when they first drink it. I remember when I was drinking, and I remember someone was giving me guidance on how to drink a beer. Now you think about how stupid that is. You've got to sit there and be taught how to drink this foul drink that tastes so bad, you've got to drink it a certain way so you will like it when you drink it. Now, that in itself ought to tell you something. But nonetheless, gulp it, they said. Swallow it. Don't sip it. If you sip it, it gets 10 times bitter than it would be if you just let it slide down your throat. All right, now why do we drink stuff like that? Well, we drink it for the effect. Maybe some people drink it because their friends are drinking, because it's cool, or whatever term you use today. But, you know, it's the thing to do. But the bottom line, the end result is somebody's drinking, somebody made the stuff, and they made it stronger and stronger and stronger for the effect. And listen to all of the things that are said about it. I'll give you a couple. You know, loosen up. Take a drink to loosen up. Chill out. In other words, the idea, I've seen countless movies where someone giving the advice, one guy giving advice to the other guy on what to do when he gets the girl back to the house. Give her a drink. Why? So she will loosen up. It's a perfect term for it. Because what alcohol tends to do is lower our inhibitions. And if you think about it, think about what happens to people as they drink. Think about the Galatians 5 passage. What happens to people when they drink? They do loosen up. They have less inhibitions. So what do you normally see? I've been to plenty of bars and so forth. What do you normally see with people who are drinking? The more they drink, the louder they become. Why? Because I would walk into a crowded room, and if I were in a crowd, if I were in a restaurant tonight or whatever, chances are great that I want to talk at least a low enough volume that everybody won't turn around and look at me. I've got inhibitions about that. I don't want people seeing me, you know, show myself, all of that kind of... What happens when you drink? You get louder and louder, and you don't care. The loudness that comes, the sexual, loose behavior that comes, you get to a point where you just don't care.
Your inhibitions drop. They lower. That's the point of alcohol. Listen to what Peter is saying. God has chosen a term here, a compound term, that teaches us the effect of alcohol is to heat us up. It's to get us hot. It's to get us to the point where we're moved to do things we might not do. Look at the passage in Galatians 5. All those terms about fighting and strife and all of that kind of thing. Well, what typically happens with people when they drink? I know what happens in my family when people drink. They get in fights. And the more they drink, the more they fight. I will never forget going in. I think it was Thanksgiving. It might have been Christmas. Doesn't matter. Some holiday. I will never forget walking in and seeing an uncle of mine, an older uncle, and he was beaten to a pulp. He was laying in a bed and the family was begging him, go back to the hospital. What happened to him? He was drinking. And he got in a fight. And these two who were drinking got in a fight and they nearly killed each other. Alcohol. Heated up. Moving you. Excessive wine. Then notice the term here in 1 Peter 4, banquetings. Here's the idea of your drinkings, your parties, the partyings, the feastings, the drinking parties. Some translation even translate it drinking parties as opposed to banquetings, which is a very outdated King James word. And then you see this abominable idolatries, and you think, well, what in the world has idolatry got to do with this set? Well, everything. Again, go back to what Hesychius was saying. All those activities that go on when they're worshiping those idols. And then look again at this next verse here. They think it's strange of you that you don't run with them in, quote-unquote, excess of riot. Now, excess here, if you've got a King James, is not the same as in the previous verse. The excess of wine and excess of riot, two different words here. The excess of riot here means, literally, excesses. Like going overboard. And the riot, you can see in many translations, profligacy, or dissipation, or something like that. In other words, just behavior that's not restrained. So you're doing things in excess. Alcohol at the very foundation of that. When you picture, and I want you to be honest with yourself. You don't have to be with anybody else right now. But when you picture a party where everybody goes too far, and you know it, maybe yourself included, do you ever once picture such a party without alcohol? One time. And just be honest with yourself. If so, it's an extremely rare party. And he's probably got some ganja or something besides the alcohol at the basis of it. We understand that. Now, said all that. Turn with me to the book of Proverbs. What does the Bible say for Christians? Well, a lot of wisdom. I'm going to choose just a couple of passages to close. In the book of Proverbs, look with me at chapter 23. No doubt you've heard the passage before, but let's think about it for a second. The wise man said it like this. Who has woe? Verse 29. Proverbs 23, verse 29. Who has woe? Who has sorrow? Who has those contentions and all that trouble? Who has babbling? We think of that loud, boisterous, don't make any sense, can't talk straight, slurring your word, all that kind of thing. Who has babbling? Who has wounds without cause? Or as some would intimate the idea here is, who suffered for no good reason. I don't know about you, but if you ever engaged in this kind of behavior and walked away and you got wounds that you carry home with you and you're asking yourself, you know, why? There wasn't any good reason for all of that. That was just stupid. Who has wounds without cause? Who has redness of eyes? A person immediately thinks of the hangover and all of the after effects. And then you listen to what he says here in verse 30. He says, they that tarry long at the wine. And then it's interesting, he said, they that go to seek mixed wine. Mixed wine would be more like the harder drinks of their day. And then he says in verse 31, he says, look not thou upon the wine when it is red, when it gives its color in the cup, when it moves itself aright. Now a person might look at that and laugh at the language. Let me give it to you in modern terms. When Dos Equis puts on their next commercial,
and you see that beautiful glass that's sparkling, that they paid tens of thousands of dollars to get it to look so perfectly. And those ice cubes hit, and the acoustics are magnificent, almost heavenly. And some bartender from high pours that alcohol. And in slow motion, it comes down, and it hits that ice cube just so. And it spreads, dissipates throughout the glass. And then that glass is handed to a goddess that sits in that bar. And she takes that glass and she said, "This is the lifestyle you want. And you can have it with Dos Equis." Now that's Proverbs 29 in modern terms. What the Bible is teaching us is you're a Christian. And you're not blinded by the beauty and the lights. If you want to let me borrow from last week's sermon, the lust of the eyes and the lust of the flesh and even the pride of life. You're not blinded by that because you see the end result. You see where this is going. You realize, if you'll turn with me to Psalm 1, that oftentimes it's a digression or progression, if you prefer, but that it comes in steps, and that's what I mean by it. I look at Psalm 1 and verse 1, and I remember a teacher at FC, might have been Farrell Jenkins, but I don't remember for sure, but boy, his point really rang home. And we looked at Psalm 1, and he said, "Blessed is the man that walks not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor stands in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of the scornful." And I never will forget the point, because he warned us as young people. And in many cases down at FC, he was talking to people who'd grown up in the church, and they hadn't gone out in the world and made a lot of mistakes. You know, I just happened to be a little bit of an exception to that, but I knew he was right. And what he was saying was this, and what he did say that day was this. Now that I think about it, it must have been John Clark that said that, but anyway. He said, "There are going to be plenty of things in life where people are going to tell you how much fun it is. Come on and do this. It's fun. You'll enjoy it. You never have done it, but you listen to what they say. You don't stop to consider, is this a godly person? You don't stop to consider the effects it's had on their life. You don't stop to think about what they're saying in comparison with what God says, but you listen." He said, that's step number one, the counsel of the ungodly. And then he said, "Nor stands in the way of sinners." You go, but you tell yourself, "I'll go, but I won't engage in what's wrong. I'll go to the party, but I won't drink. I'll dance, but I won't lust. I'll go this far, but I won't go that far." He says, at that point, even then, you're standing in the way of sinners. You're not running with them like Peter talks about, but you're there. And then he said, if you'll notice, "nor sits in the seat of the scornful." And he said something profound, and I want you to hear this, because it was true of me, and I dare say it's probably true of most people. If I can think of myself as going to the party or whatever, and I can see me standing, and I'd always think of me standing close to the door, you know? So if I wanted to leave, I could leave. And I always tell myself, I can leave. And he said, if you're standing there and you're standing close to the door, well, you picture yourself as having the ability to walk out anytime you want to. And he said, you know what's going to happen to you? Next thing you know, you're going to be sitting on the couch in the back of the room doing what you told yourself you would never do. Happens almost 100% of the time. Now, I know from my life he's dead right. What do you think? I'll ask you a couple of questions. You know, someone might say to me, one drink doesn't have to be associated with all that. And you said social drinking lifestyle. One drink doesn't mean all of that. You know, you're right. Maybe. How honest really is that?
How honest is it to say one drink doesn't mean all of that? Even if it, and I'll say it like this, it hasn't yet for you. Has it meant more of that lifestyle for you than if you wouldn't make the first compromise? And has it meant far more of that lifestyle for many other people you know? And I'll just leave that as a question. Someone else might say to me, just because you take a drink doesn't mean you're going to get drunk. It doesn't mean you're going to become an alcoholic. It doesn't mean you're going to become sexually promiscuous. It doesn't mean you're going to do this or do that. Well, it's very similar to the first question, isn't it? That's true. But you know, the age-old answer to that is really true. Doesn't mean you won't either. Every alcoholic started with one. Every person that engaged in every sin there is in God's book started with one tiny step. Everyone. I may feel invincible and believe myself to be above it, but how honest is it really? And you know, this one that someone said to me, people just don't think of drinking the same way they used to. Now, I'd launch into an hour-long history lesson, but I ain't going to do that. People just don't think of drinking and partying the same way they used to. And I'll say this. They don't. I mean, really, they don't. You say, well, I look around me and I see that most of the world thinks that drinking and partying is okay. Most of their world do too. Every guy that ever wrote anything in this book, his world was filled with it. But I won't even use that. I'll say go back and look at the woman that I started with who converted to Christianity because of her priest standing over her, breathing alcohol in her face. I mean, is it honest to say, would even the average, and I'll go so far as to say worldly person, would they associate drinking and partying and clubbing and all of the things that we think of in that whole big scene, would they associate it with what's holy, what's spiritual, what's religious? Would they? Go a step further. Would you feel comfortable if Jesus were to come over tonight? Would you feel comfortable saying to Jesus, let's go to this party I'm about to go to? Or let's go to this club. Would you take him in there and sit down at that table, or whatever it is that's in there, and all the activity that's going to happen, going on around you, would you feel comfortable taking Jesus with you and saying, hey Jesus, share this with me today? And if not, why not? If you're here tonight and you're not a Christian, you believe in Jesus. You believe that He's the Son of God who gave His life for you. Tonight you'll repent, be baptized for forgiveness of your sins. You can be a Christian. And if you're here and you've been baptized, and you know there's something in your life that's not right and you want to put it behind you, you want to ask for forgiveness and walk with the Lord again. You know, Jesus is amazing. He's awesome. He has the ability far above any of us to forgive, to forget, and you'd be perfectly right in His sight. Won't you please come while we stand and sing?